KU's lead center is turning 25, and what better way to celebrate it than with the Rock Chalk Suite, which you just listened to. The suite is a series of pieces commissioned by the center honoring KU basketball legends including Wilt, Paul Pierce, Lynette Woodard, and Danny Manning. This is high-flying stuff, and it's performed by the best-known jazz orchestra in the world, and that's the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, who joins us now from New York. Wynton, welcome. What a pleasure to have you.
All right. It's my pleasure to be here and to speak with you. Thank you so much.
And our condolences on the passing of your father a few weeks ago, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell us how this project came about, Wynton.
Derek Kwan is the executive director of the Lead Center, and he worked at Jazz Lincoln Center for many years, a valued employee. We cried when he left. And he's absolutely my man. I worked very closely with him for years in concerts and touring. And he's also a jazz musician, and he knows that we love basketball. David Stern, the late commissioner, was on our board for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So he, being at KU with that fantastic tradition, he came up with a great idea of our entire orchestra writing pieces, because he knows that we all compose and arrange. And each member of the orchestra write a different piece for a different basketball legend. And we could bring these two traditions together and get people in the community involved in it and the different basketball players. And it was a fantastic idea, and it was great in its execution and in the feeling that it left with all of us.
Huh. How many of these commissions does Jazz at Lincoln Center take on during the course of a typical year?
You know, we all do a significant amount of arranging and composing, but we've never done one. I think this is the first thing we ever did where everybody wrote a song. We have 10 or 11 arrangers, so we're very unusual in the history of our music. There's never been a group with this many arrangers and composers. But DK, we call Derek Kwan DK, DK knew everyone and he knew their style. So I think we were arguing about who had done the most arrangements. And it was between Victor and Ted down through the years, and they both had about 115 to 120 arrangements they had done.
Wow. Well, each movement, as you've said, on this album takes inspiration from a different KU Hoops legend. You took the great Lynette Woodard, the four-time All-American. Let's listen to a bit of it here. How did you approach this piece, Wynton?
Well, Lynette, for some reason, I always tell her we knew about her when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. We're kind of from the same time. And we were always speculating on whether she would be the first woman to play in the pros. And she did end up playing professional basketball with the Harlem Globetrotters. But I played basketball too early in high school. And I loved her game, and I call it lyrical Lynette because her game was always lyrical.
Mm-hmm.
And she's one of those kind of players, very heady, extremely intelligent, got a beautiful, sweet game. You know, her game has a complexity to it. So I tried to put her in five and give her kind of rolling, sophisticated things and show different parts of her game and mine. And she also came to the concert, and she is an unbelievable presence.
Huh.
Like she's so deeply soulful and a person who brings such a positivity and a warmth to every occasion. And when she got around the band, she actually came to New York when we were recording and sat through the sessions and everything. And she's just wonderful.
Did you have to go back and look at her playing on old tape, or were you so familiar with her, Wynton, that you sort of knew how to approach her to begin with?
Well, I was familiar with her, but I still went back and went through her history and looked at her games. And, you know, what she's doing now and things that she said, I remembered her. She stood out, you know, even in high school, because she was a legend of state basketball as a high school student.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she got to KU, she was then she was in the Olympics and, you know, all the different things that she did. Because I also remember that when the WNBA was formed, Lynette was near the end of her career, you know. And I can remember thinking, damn, it's just she still could play now. She could ball. But it wasn't, if they would have had that when she was 21 or 22, oh, man, you wouldn't have been, she'd have been eating people up.
Huh. There are also pieces in here for Nick Collison, Andrew Wiggins, Fog Allen, and there's one titled The Shot for Mario Chalmers. Was it DK who decided which composer was going to get which player?
Well, we got a list. We got a list of players, and we went. I think I don't know if I decided it or I sent it out to everybody. I think I kind of decided it. What normally happens is I decide, and then the guys come back and they say, "Wait, I want this one or I don't." You know what? We worked it out a bit amongst each other. I don't think DK. He might have just told me to do Wilt, but I'm not sure because you know when we were with DK, he's like part of the family too. So whatever we all lead and follow each other in a kind of funny way.
Huh. So what did you learn about KU basketball as a result of all this?
Well, I'm a basketball fan, so you know I knew about that tradition, but I didn't equate James Naismith with KU for some reason. You know, I always thought of him as the why. And other things, other players I didn't know. You know, Darnell Valentine, I didn't know his game. Of course, I knew Paul Pierce. The younger players, I would know. I knew the story of Wilt. I remember seeing Wilt cry. I knew about him losing the championship. Clyde Lovellette, I didn't know him. Beautiful person.
Right.
And
right.
Also a man who came to the sessions, Walt Wesley, also a gentleman, like just an old-school gentleman. Deeply soulful, tall, just beautiful to be in his presence. So there were things I learned about players. Foggy Allen's coaching style I didn't really know about, but then you know I learned about it. And being a basketball fan, I knew about the tradition. I knew about the tradition when we began to work on it. Of course, I learned in much greater detail particulars about the tradition that I did not know.
I'm visiting with Wynton Marsalis about the new Rock Chalk Suite, which commemorates KU basketball over the decades. You know, it's hard not to notice the connection between jazz and basketball with all that improvisation. How does improvisation in a sport like basketball compare to improvisation in jazz? Because I'm guessing there's some similarities here.
Definitely. Well, it's improvisation in the context of form. So even if you see like a player go between their legs with the basketball or around their back or get low to dribble or do the kind of jump step that the European ball players do or kind of back away fade away jump shot or they fake like they're going in one direction they pull the ball back the other way, all the different things you see they are improvisations on a convention, and that's how jazz is. You know the melody of a song, but I take another route. So I say, okay, you know this melody, Happy Birthday. Do do dee do dee dee. But I say, do be de do bo do bo de bo do bo de be de be de. So I start to make up different melodic things on a melody you know, on a form that you know. We know what the basketball court looks like. We know what a half court line is. We know what a free throw line is. We know the out of bounds marks. It's like knowing the form of a blues. So inside of that form, I'm going to execute all kind of ideas and phrases and things that will seem like I'm not in the form, but I am in it. That's like ball players flying and playing above the rim. It's like really creative passing, no-look passes, and anything that plays with the convention. And also there's speed of thought, like the way a person like Steph Curry can get off one of those jump shots in less than a split second, 30 feet from the basket, and get you.
Right.
That's like the ability to think very quickly and execute something in at the speed of instinct. So those are the similarities, but also the positions are similar. Like a center is like a bass player. A power forward is like a drummer. A point guard is like a leader of a band that's a horn player.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of brainiest player is like a piano player. A player who's like a coach on the court is like a piano player.
Huh.
So on and so forth.
Well, I know what you can do with the trumpet, but what can you do on the basketball court?
Man, at this stage, I can only talk about a game. I had a decent game for a musician. You know, for many years I would go to schools, and that's the only way I could get kids to learn about music. I have to take them out on the court and give them my education.
Yeah, I get it.
Because I grew up playing a lot of basketball, you know, and I used to always tell them, son, a liberal arts education extends far outside the classroom. But at this point, I'm only relegated to lying about how good my game was.
Yeah, I get it. I'm in the same boat. Well, when you think of the sounds of basketball, you think of squeaky shoes and whistles from the referees. Were you able to incorporate those elements into this album?
Yeah, definitely. Ted Nash's piece, Fog Allen, has a trumpet
Yes, yes.
We're making sounds like that.
Yes.
Sound like the court. It's called Marcus Prentice, JoJo's Mojo. We have the whistle blowing in that one. We have in Darnell Valentine's, we have the countdown, and then the trumpets played up with the horn and Victor's arrangement. Yeah, oh yeah, we have a lot of little basketball sounds in some of them. People shouting defense.
So all these pieces get written, then the band comes together to play them. How much rewriting goes on at that point in the process as you guys all gather to put the thing down?
You know, we rewrite some stuff, but not a lot. You know, most of it, the arrangements, you spend your time, you think about them. And also, we've been writing for a long time. We will change sections every now and then and make little changes. But we do whatever is required to make the piece sound good, and we all work on the pieces together. So it's interesting if you're in a band with 14, 15 people and every person arranges. So while they're playing the first time down, it might sound terrible. But when we get to that second and third time, because every person is figuring out who are they cross voice with, what's their note in the chord. There's a level of intelligence they're focusing on each other's arrangements. It's uncommon because they're not just playing a trombone part or a trumpet part.
Yeah.
They understand the function of the part. And, you know, we all suggest things. Carlos will say something about the rhythms. If it's a certain way, Dan is voicing, and we're talking about who am I doubling. And to see us rehearse is fascinating, especially in this period, because we've been together so long, and we play so much really complex music, and we can get it together in a short time. That we really have worked out a way of working with each other that has a tremendous amount of mutual respect.
Hmm. Whit Marsalis is my guest. We're talking about the new album, Rock Chalk Suite, commemorating great KU basketball players over the years. Let's play another piece from this album. This is the opening track, The Wise Guy. This is for James Naismith. You know, Whit, it's a weird time to be talking about basketball, you know, and music for that matter, since right now, it's difficult to see both of them live. But at the same time, maybe putting out albums like this right now are sort of a way we can enjoy them in some form, right?
Definitely. I mean, this is, you know, that we're doing what we have to do to be safe. Who could have known that a pathogen could cross the world and put it, send everybody inside?
Yeah.
We couldn't have known that, but we have to respond to changes. And it's part of them. Jazz music is all about resilience. So just because we're inside doesn't mean we forget the things that we love to do or the things that make us us. And, yeah, it's great to put music out, to read new books, to look at things that we wouldn't have seen, and to try to go in a substantive direction and be productive with the time that we do have. So with Jazz Lincoln Center, we love it.
Yeah, I always think of you guys as working closely together from a physical standpoint, a proximity standpoint. Do you have to distance now when you're in the studio or you're working together in rehearsal?
We don't work together in rehearsal. We're all in our home. So the things that we put out now, we do it remotely.
Okay.
We live in different places in the country. But when we get on the phone with each other, we see each other, we start laughing. We play together a long time. So the orchestra is very, very tight and unified. And we have a very strong spirit, and even in this time, I mean, we have an orchestra call today because we're doing another virtual recording of a piece called "Everybody Wear Your Mask." So, but when we do that, we laugh and we joke with each other. You know, it's just
yeah.
I mean, it's not. We're dedicated, and I think our organization is that way too. People have remained dedicated, and we're trying to figure out how to manage and work our way out of this situation to be able to transition to whatever comes next.
So how are you holding up? I mean, Jazz at Lincoln Center is quiet these days. You're not on the road. You just lost your dad. Tough times, Winton?
No, I grew up in around such dysfunction, man. People were struggling so much in the kind of 60s, South segregation and all that. Yeah, my dad was so soulful, man. He had been sick for a while. He was taking a lot of medications every day. And my mother died before him. She had dementia for 8 years. She just slowly declined. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a thing that happens to all of us as we get older. If we're lucky, many of us parents die early or younger, suddenly in a shocking way. For me, you know, my father, and he was a very non-dramatic type of guy, very matter of fact, and he was so cool and so, he had such a broad viewpoint. And we were joking about it. It's not funny now, but I joke with him all the time because he was very serious. So we were joking about, is it his time for COVID and all this kind of stuff. An observation he made at that time, he was, man, you know, if your loved one dies, it's no more significant than all the other people whose loved ones are dying. It doesn't mean any more. It means the same to everybody, and all of the deaths together mean the same thing. But he also accepted the cycle of life, and that, you know, things happen, and it hits me like I couldn't sleep last night. So, yeah, it hits me on a very, very deep kind of level, because that was my man. I mean, I hung with him. I went everywhere with him. But it's a part of the road we must all go down. And it's a fact of life.
You know, you wrote something about him on Facebook when he passed that I wanted to ask you about. You wrote this, and I'm going to quote here. As a boy, I followed him on so many underpopulated gigs in unglamorous places, and there, in the passing years, learned what it meant to believe in the substance of a fundamental idea whose only verification was your belief. Tell us about that and what you meant.
I mean, you know, it's like you're 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. You're following like a guy around. He's playing in places that are like southern, like a step above a dive, basically dive. It would be dives except there's a kind of restaurant attached to it, restaurant, bar, grill, 60s. And he's playing for, you know, 5 people, 7, 3, 8, 9 people. People rather turn the jukebox on a lot of times and listen to whatever the popular music of the day was. He's trying to play jazz. They don't really want to necessarily hear that. But they're respected musicians at that time. People knew maybe a little more about music, or probably more musicians they were encountering. It wasn't glamorous. It was just a guy in the South with his kids. You're like the youngest kid in the place. And people, you know, some people drunk, some people struggling with their lives. And it wasn't like a movie. It was just a fact of what it was. And to see that he just could continue to play as the years passed, and the way he would play always with intensity, with feeling, and the belief that he showed when nobody else believed in it. So I would be, once again, most of my relationship with my father, I would tease him a lot just because he was so serious. I would always be joking with him. I'd be like, man, we're going to another gig with 3 people. Or, you know, when you going to stop playing this music? Man, I'm tempted to just turn the jukebox on while y'all are playing. I was just clowning and messing with him. And you know, I can't recount it because you have to know how he was to know how crazy it was. I mean, I would just tell him any kind of stuff to make him laugh. And he would laugh at it. He'd be like, man, you crazy. And we'd be driving back from a gig that had 8 people in it. I'd be like, well, you know, we had 8 people at that gig. So it was just to see him do that. And he never complained. He just played. And he could play good, too. And my father could play.
Oh, he could.
So it just made me, you know, it just made me understand. Sometimes you believe in something and you don't get the external verification of it. If you have a belief and you believe in something that's important and it's of a quality and value, he worked hard on it.
Yeah.
And I could never understand why he did it. But as I grew older, I understood. So by the time I got to be 14 or 15, I understood the type of dedication and belief that you had to have to be at peace with yourself, with the decisions you make, and to mind your creativity. So I always think about it and about him.
Yeah. You know, he performed here at the Folly Theater a few years ago, and I interviewed him on stage before the show, and I got to tell you, Whitten, I had a hard time getting a word in. He could talk.
You know, he could go, man. As I put that in there, too. We used to always say, if he say in a nutshell, you'd be like, no, not in a nutshell. That's 15 minutes. So, because I teased him all the time, I would get him. He'd say, well, man, in a nutshell. No, man, not in a nutshell. Give me the long version so it'll be shorter.
I could only imagine. I think I had like 15.
Oh, man,
I think I got 2 questions of the 15 I was going to ask him that night. You know.
Oh man, we would mess with it. We used to say he could go. That's what we call it in New Orleans. If you're talking like, man, woo, your boy can go. He could go.
He was a big fan of our very own Charlie Parker out here, whose 100th birthday we're celebrating this year. How is Jazz at Lincoln Center planning to celebrate this big birthday in the world of jazz?
We're opening our season with a with a Charlie Parker a concert, and we're going to feature two fantastic alto saxophone, three fantastic alto saxophone players of a younger generation. And, you know, it's going to be swinging. And when you hear them play, it's going to be everything that they're going to speak for us. And we're going to also go on tour if we're touring at that time and if we can do that. And we're going to feature Bird's music and talk about him. We're going to have education on Bird. And we'll do all we can to put him in the perspective we think he should be placed in.
You know, when he passed away, people thought, the doctor thought he was in his mid-50s or even 60. He was 34 years old. And I still, after living here for so many years and hearing so many people talk about him, almost can't believe he only lived 34 years and yet had the outsized impact that he wound up having.
Well, it's just the depth of his genius. He showed us another way to hear rhythm. He had an unbelievable quickness of mind. I talked to Dizzy one time. He said, man, the notes that came out of Charlie Parker's horn was not like other people's notes. He said, Bird, some deep notes came out of his horn. And Jerry Mulligan told me a funny story once about Charlie Parker. He said that they were at a jazz at the Philharmonic with a bunch of saxophone players, great saxophone players, you know, Ben Carter, him, Flip Phillips.
Yeah.
He named a bunch of great musicians. He said they were all warming up playing, and Bird was late. So they started to complain about Bird. Oh, man, Bird is always late. Bird, you know, Bird's going to come in here high. And they were making a lot of noise like saxophone players would do. So Bird came in, you know, disheveled, high, late, started putting his horn together. And this is after everybody had talked about how Bird wasn't this and Bird wasn't that. He said that Bird played a single scale on his horn when he got it put together. He said he ran up the scale. He said it was the most perfect thing you ever heard. He said, and in that moment, all of us stopped playing and looked at Bird.
Wow.
He said, and in the silence of all of these great saxophone players, he's some of the greatest saxophone players who've ever lived. He said, and in the silence of the moment of us all looking at Bird, we all understood why he was Bird and we weren't.
Wow. Good story.
So just the way he described it, yeah, the way he described it, too, Jerry was real colorful with his stories.
Hmm. How is jazz at Lincoln Center getting through this time? What are you worried about?
You know, revenue. I mean, it's hard. We have a large budget. We have to earn money. We have to rent our building. We go on tours. We play concerts. We also support a lot of musicians in our ecosystem. A lot of musicians now out of work. A lot of paychecks, salaries. And then we're inside of a larger ecosystem that too is struggling. So, you know, all of a sudden you don't have the ability to earn money, and you still have bills, you still have expenses, so we're doing all we can to continue to manage through things, get things up online, encourage people to donate to us. We're dropping all the kind of veneer of pride that you normally have, and we're saying, hey, we got to go back to the time when Bach and them would write those long salutations to kings and queens so that they could continue to write music. Let's go back to just old PTA. You know, we're starting a baseball team in the community. Can you give some uniforms? Or can you? Mm-hmm. So we're going old school, and we're putting out more music. We're getting out with the things we're doing through our portal, and we're being very active. We're talking. We're remaining even more focused and organized about how we manage our staff and what we're trying to do as a team, repurposing what we do across different lines so everybody can be in a job that helps us with our three-month virtual season, hoping that the country will begin to open up and it'll be safe to open up, because we don't want people to open up and get sick again. But we're just hoping that we can conduct some business, and we're more worried about freelance musicians and people who don't have any type of infrastructure to support them, which is a lot of our field, how a three-month layoff is going to devastate them and their ability to feed their families.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to think about what this pandemic means for the future of jazz, or really any kind of live music for that matter?
Yeah, I thought about it, but I don't think it's going to mean that much for it. I mean, people are going to be happy to be out. People don't want to be inside all the time. I think maybe younger people who grew up on computers or playing video games, they might like to do that, but we love each other. And the thing that the pandemic has proven to us without a doubt is how much contact we have with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We contact each other. We're on Earth. We're human beings, and all of us together form like an organism. So, it's not taught me that we're all going to be separate from each other and live in cubicles like robots. It's taught me that We love being with each other, and the people are interconnected. It's a thing that jazz has known its entire life. And I don't, the opposite of anticipating the time that no one will go outside, I anticipate more people coming out and more people. Mm-hmm. And as soon as there's a vaccine and they're safe, people are going to love each other more and enjoy the company of other people. And that's what we're saying to each other on the phone. I'm talking to friends I have all over the world, we're saying, man, when we see each other again, we're going to enjoy our presence much more than we did before.
You know, I'm visiting with Wynton Marsalis. A lot of folks may not realize that you play the opening theme to CBS Sunday Morning, which is a great news show, and the theme you play is just remarkable. Please tell me that piece is difficult to play. I've seen you perform it. They've showed tape of you doing it. Tell me you had to work on that thing a while before you sat down and knocked that thing out.
I didn't knock it out. Yeah, I had to work on it. But I had actually not played classical music for a long time. And I came back and did it. It's called The Oblazin. It was written by Gottfried Reich, who was a Bach's trumpet player. That Bach wrote some of the most difficult music ever written for the clarino trumpet. The famous piece that Bach wrote is called Brandenburg Concerto No. 2. Mm-hmm. Most impossible to play. But The Oblazin is very difficult to play. And mainly I was relying on just the years that I really practiced on that piccolo trumpet all through high school. I spent hours trying to learn how to play it. And I was influenced by the great French trumpeter, Maurice André. And when I was called to do it, I actually thought I could play it in a couple of times. It took me a long time to get it right.
I'm really glad to hear that. You're making me feel better here.
I'm telling you, because I told Steve Epstein was produce all of my classical music recordings I made. I don't know, it was maybe 8 or 9 years since I had even played a piccolo trumpet. So I told Steve, it'll take me, I'll do it 2 or 3 times, that'll be it. Man, I was struggling with that thing.
Well, I am relieved to hear that, actually. Two final points. I've read a lot of your books. What's your next one going to be about? Because you write about the music in such a thoughtful way, and it always strikes me as a lifelong journalist that writing about music is so difficult, and you've done it a lot. Where are you going next?
I think I'm going to write a history of Afro-American music with Jeff Ward.
Wow.
And Jeff Ward is a writer. He's my friend. I go to his house every Sunday. He writes a lot of Ken Burns' documentary. He's a great American historian. I love him.
Yeah.
He's my man. We got like, you know, 30-year relationship of just talking about things. And
amazing writer. Just an amazing writer.
Yeah. A great person. And his wife, Diane, is a writer also. So we just have years of sitting up in their kitchen on a Sunday, man, talking about politics and America and history. And just one story, he took me up to Connecticut to meet David Blight, who had written Frederick Douglass's book, autobiography of Frederick Douglass, just won a lot of awards. And I was just looking at the two of them. I don't know, they're in their late 70s, early 80s, whatever. And I was just thinking about just kind of all the wisdom and the kind of feeling between the two men. And you know, it's just that try to convey the type of wisdom and depth of study and the tradition that they come out of. I try as I get older to emulate a lot of the feeling and intensity they have. I mean, Jeff is working on 10 or 11 things right now. So that's what I'll probably do next. And I don't know, other things. I write down a lot of different things. I think with my father passing, just to write about what it was like growing up and all of that. But I don't know.
Right. Just a final thing. You know, 15 years ago, Jazz at Lincoln Center hosted a Kansas City music weekend, you know, brought a lot of the old cats out for the weekend. Bobby Watson came out, and they sent our radio show out there to cover that weekend with you all. And I got to tell you something, Wynton, because we got out there on a Friday evening, you know, hassle getting from the airport, got to Jazz at Lincoln Center for the first time. And I walked into that one auditorium that has the 40 or 50 foot windows overlooking Columbus Circle and the park, you know, Central Park out there. And
right.
Bobby Watson starts to play. And I got to tell you something, and I've only had this experience a few times in my life this way, but I thought I was in heaven. It was a beautiful evening. The rush hour traffic outside, people going home, the park out there, twinkling lights. And I'm sitting in this space. I know you're there all the time, so maybe it's lost on you a little bit. But I just thought to myself, this is about as good as it gets. It was just a spectacular night.
Man, thank you so much. You know, yeah. I love Bobby. We played together with Art Blakey. And,
I know.
Called the Appel Room. It's the Appel Room, and I just appreciate your testimonial about it. You know, we built it. We struggled a lot to get stuff off the ground, and a lot went on in our organization. Brought us a lot closer together. Then they killed us, but that's why we wanted to build it there, so you could have exactly those kind of experiences, and I really appreciate hearing about it.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. Well, that's Wynton Marsalis. The new album, Rock Chalk Suite, we'll have it available up on our website here. Wynton, what a pleasure to have you. I sure enjoyed the time, and of course, I'll be watching closely and wishing you all the best.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm very appreciative.